This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Barack Obama sucks. Look, just stay with me here, because Obamacare's in the news. It's in the news because nobody can afford health insurance anymore. We actually just renewed our health insurance, that annual thing you have to do. And you know, it's company insurance. It should be good. It's trash. It's so expensive. Normal people can't afford health insurance. It's awful. And it wasn't always that way. But that brings us back to the man who authored the current health care crisis, the crisis being you can't afford it. Barack Obama is his name. Barack Obama, who's doing the podcast circuit, lying through his teeth.
We have blown through, just in the last 6 months, a whole range of not simply assumptions, but rules and laws and practices that were put in place to ensure that nobody's above the law, and that we don't use the federal government to simply reward our friends and punish our enemies. And the same thing's obviously happening in the Justice Department.
Yeah, that's the guy who sent the FBI and CIA after Donald Trump. Also, why does he sit like that? No man should ever sit like that. It's so feminine. It really bothers me. But we're not going to major on that right now. I do want to remind you about something. Just the poison that Barack Obama put in the bloodstream of this country. Mass shootings. It's going to happen. They're the worst thing in the world. It's someone shoots up the school, shoots up something. It's just the worst thing in the world. We all hate it. But there's something that happens today that maybe you just have baked in the cake. That something being Democrats in the media, Democrat politicians all over social media, they will immediately, when a mass shooting, honestly, while it's still happening, they will immediately start gun grabbing. Immediately. You see it. I don't have to repeat it. You've seen it over and over and over again. But you should understand, it was not always this way. For most of my life, when I paid attention to politics, that's not something that really happened. If there was a terrible tragedy, a mass shooting of some kind, politicians would normally be real stoic about the whole thing, maybe get up and give a speech, hey, let's all come together, we need to pray, that kind of a thing. So why do they all do the opposite now? Why do they all stand on the dead bodies and immediately start grabbing for your guns? Well, I'll tell you why. Barack Obama is why.
This is not about politics. This is about these families and families all across the country who are saying, let's make it a little harder for our kids to get gunned down.
The fact that 26-year-olds were gunned down in the most violent fashion possible and this town couldn't do anything about it was stunning to me. And so the question then becomes, what can we do about it? The only thing that's going to change is public opinion. If public opinion does not demand change in Congress, it will not change.
Each time we see one of these mass shootings, our thoughts and prayers are not enough.
He put that in the bloodstream of this country. Now, Democrats think it's normal. They all do it. A true revolutionary who would never dream of just bringing the country together. Everything was an opportunity to move the revolution forward. But let's focus for a moment on his signature piece of legislation, Obamacare. To our credit, we knew it was a disaster. The right railed and railed and railed against Obamacare when he was out there trying to sell it to America. And of course, we got this courtesy of Mays Moore. They lied through his teeth about the whole thing.
it will actually reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over the long term. Reducing the waste and inefficiency in Medicare and Medicaid will pay for most of this plan. It will slow the growth of healthcare costs for our families, our businesses, and our government. There will be a provision in this plan that requires us to come forward with more spending cuts if the savings we promised don't materialize.
You can't afford health insurance because Barack Obama and the Democrats passed Obamacare. Insurance companies raking in record profits. I don't mind when companies make profits, but you can't afford health insurance. Insurance companies have record profits, and now we're stuck with this. And I'm sorry, I can't help but think about all those Republicans who ran for office, House and Senate and President, promising that they would repeal it. We will repeal it. We'll repeal it. We'll repeal it. In fact, while Democrats, while Barack Obama was president, Democrats had control, right? They could veto things. Republicans in the House of Representatives voted 7 times to repeal Obamacare when they knew Barack Obama would, of course, strike that down. Then, after Donald Trump won in 2016, we had the House, we had the Senate, we had the presidency. They failed to repeal Obamacare. Now we are in this awful situation where people can't afford health care. They can't afford health insurance because the GOP never repealed it and because Democrats passed it. Now Trump's out there saying things like this.
Well, I watched Obama from when this thing came about. As you know, I opposed the verse strongly. Unfortunately, we had a couple of negative votes, which should never have happened. But I said it's going to be a disaster, and I was exactly right. The premiums have gone up like rocket ships, and I'm not just talking about recently. I'm talking about for years they've been going up. And he said premiums will go down. Everything will be wonderful. It's horrible health insurance at a very high price. And what I want, and probably what you're alluding to, is the fact that I want, instead of going to the insurance companies, I want the money to go into an account for people where the people buy their own health insurance. It's so good. The insurance will be better. It'll cost less. Everybody's going to be happy. They're going to feel like entrepreneurs. They're actually able to go out and negotiate their own health insurance. And they can use it only for that reason. That's the beauty, only for that purpose. And if we did that, that would be so exciting. Call it Trump care, call it whatever you want to call it, but anything but Obamacare. Obamacare is a disaster, just like he was as a president.
Okay, sounds good. Mike Johnson's out there saying things like this.
We are subsidizing very wealthy insurance companies. That is not helping costs go down. It's driving premiums up even higher. So Republicans want to fix the broken system. We don't want to throw good money at a broken and failing system. And the Unaffordable Care Act has been that since it was signed into law, passed by the Democrats alone back in 2010. We've got to reduce the cost of health care and the cost of living, by the way, and Republicans are the ones that have the ideas to do that.
Okay, that's good. We have ideas. Do we really, though? Are we going to do something? Because I've walked down this road for too long. We're going to repeal it. We're going to repeal it. We're going to repeal and replace it. You say you have ideas. Scott Bessent didn't sound quite as confident.
The president has also come forward with a new proposal overnight saying it's time instead to do away with Obamacare, instead to have the money go directly to the people. Do you have a formal proposal to do that?
We don't have a formal proposal, but you know what I have noticed over time is that the Democrats give all these bills the Orwellian names, the Affordable Care Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and we end up with just the opposite. You know, the Affordable Care Act has become unaffordable, and the Inflation Reduction Act set off the greatest inflation in 50 years.
Well, I'm a little confused because the president has been posting about that overnight and into this morning, but you're not proposing that to the Senate right now?
We're not proposing it to the Senate right now.
All right. Look, we need to do something. We have the House, we have the Senate, we have the presidency. I understand there are limits on what laws we can get through the Senate because we don't have 60 votes. I understand that. But it's been too long. And right now what's happening is people are sticker shocked beyond belief for their health insurance, and Republicans need to put forward concrete proposals, a law even, that will help, that will get the government out of it. And if we do not, you know what's going to happen? Not for you or me, but you know what's going to happen? The normies out there, They're going to look to Democrats who will promise to give them more money. They will. We have to do something. Let's get something done. But hey, it is the GOP after all. Gut health. You ever hear that term now? Oh, what about your gut health? I always mocked it, to be honest with you. But that's because my stomach, for almost all of my life, can handle anything. Jalapenos, it doesn't matter. My stomach can handle anything. But you notice something when you turn 44 that you didn't notice when you turn 24. There are limits. Now, what do you do to make sure your gut is in good health? Colostrum, cowboy colostrum. Someone told me it's a must. If you want your gut to feel good, it's a must. Okay, I decided to try it. Wow. And it's delicious. I have the chocolate kind. I put 2 scoops in my coffee every single morning. I have chocolate coffee. Delicious. My gut feels good. Go get some cowboy colostrum for your gut health. Go to cowboycolostrum.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
We will keep this promise to the American people. If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor, period. If you like your health care plan, you will be able to keep your health care plan, period.
If you like your doctor or health care plan, you can keep it.
Nothing in this plan will require you or your employer to change the coverage of the doctor you have.
The only change you'll see are falling costs as our reforms take hold.
If you like your healthcare system and your doctor, the only thing reform will mean to you is your healthcare will cost less. I will not sign a plan that adds one dime to our deficits, either now or in the future. It is a cost that will not, I repeat, will not add to our deficits.
We'll eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse in our healthcare system, but we'll also take on key causes of rising costs, saving billions while providing better care to the American people.
Well, that was all a freaking lie. Thanks to Tom Elliott at Grabian for all that, by the way. Joining me now, the great Dr. Aaron Cariotti, author of the book Making the Cut. Doctor, people, especially younger people, they don't even remember what healthcare was like before Obamacare. I remember going to a family doctor, and he actually talked to me instead of facing the computer the entire time. What was healthcare like back in the day?
That's right. And I think the folks who were around when Obama was saying those things and believed him, perhaps voted for him, perhaps supported the so-called Affordable Care Act, I would imagine can't help watching a clip like that and putting their face in their palm and thinking, well, no, none of that turned out to be true. In fact, the exact opposite turned out to be true. I didn't keep my doctor. My health insurance premiums went up. We didn't cut out the bureaucratic middleman. Those administrative costs in healthcare have only ballooned. And I'm getting care that feels much less personalized. So yes, there was a time when you'd go to the physician and instead of staring at a computer screen and checking boxes and asking questions that had very little to do with your chief complaint, that were in fact dictated by outside forces, by managerialist forces, whether those were coming from Medicare and Medicaid at the federal level or enormous corporate conglomerates that had swallowed up the local hospital or the local healthcare clinic. People had personal relationships with their physicians not that long ago. Their physicians looked at them, examined them, asked them questions about the thing that they brought in to get help with. And all of that, unfortunately, has gone out the window. And doctors are frustrated. Doctors are leaving medicine or retiring early in droves. I have stats on this in the opening chapter of The New Abnormal. Patients are clearly unsatisfied with the current status quo. So those promises were made, obviously failed to deliver on those promises. And now we're left with a system in which the bloat of the middleman has grown to enormous proportions. In fact, if you take all the people in medicine that have some face-to-face contact with patients, doctors, nurses, x-ray technicians, the front office staff, anyone who, you know, looks a patient in the face and says hello, and then you take all the people in the healthcare bureaucracy that never have any face time, any face-to-face contact with the patient, however brief, the latter category currently has more people than the former category. So we have this whole layer of unseen bureaucracy in healthcare that's enormously expensive. And so we need to find ways to cut out the middleman that's working for the hospital compliance office, that's fighting with Medicare regarding reimbursement, the middleman at Medicare who's fighting with your hospital compliance office behind the scenes about reimbursement, and all the people who are not actually contributing to patient care that are just driving up costs. We need to find ways to decentralize our healthcare system with federal dollars. All that always comes with strings attached. We know that, right? And so whenever you get the federal government too involved in healthcare, and I'm not saying we can't have, it shouldn't have any federal regulation in healthcare, but healthcare really falls to the states to regulate. And the federal government's role should be minimal. And I think we can find ways to deliver more affordable care. In the closing chapters of The New Abnormal, I talk about some models that are out there of direct primary care, of cooperative programs that are competing now with health insurance programs, able to negotiate prices directly with physicians and providers and do all kinds of creative things to cut out the middleman. But that requires enough deregulation that we give doctors and small-scale localized healthcare systems room to maneuver and room to be able to operate without being swallowed up by the federal bureaucracy, without being swallowed up by the giant corporate conglomerates that are currently monopolizing healthcare in the United States.
Doctor, do these proposals you lay out in your book, The New Abnormal, do these proposals, are they possible to do while Obamacare is still in existence? And I ask that because I have no faith that the GOP is actually going to be able to repeal the freaking thing. Can we do these things while still under the burden of Obamacare is what I want to know.
We can to some extent. In fact, some of them are already being done in certain states and in certain regions. So there are creative workarounds. These bureaucratic hurdles do not make that easy, but it's not impossible. We need what the Czech dissidents of the 1970s called a parallel polis, basically parallel medical institutions that sort of opt out of the current system. And look, if the federal government decided to target any one or another of those small-scale initiatives, they could certainly crush it. If the corporate conglomerates decided to target these initiatives, they could swallow them up and put them out of business. But the idea of these Soviet dissidents living in the Czech Republic in the 1970s, Václav Havel, Václav Benda, others who wrote about this, was that you create so many of these that it's impossible to stomp them all out. So any one or another of them could be targeted for elimination by, you know, by the great beast. But if you have enough of them, basically eventually they start competing with the mainstream institutions. They circle back and start influencing those mainstream institutions because they grow, you know, significant enough that you can't ignore them anymore. I think a good analogy for what we need in medicine is actually the homeschooling movement, which started 50 years ago in the 1970s. And basically you were working outside the system. And back in the day, you know, don't tell the neighbors that we're homeschooling our own kids, that we're taking responsibility for their education, because they may call Child Protective Services and literally have us put in jail. But for decades, homeschoolers realized, no, we can actually educate our children better than the public school system. And we can prove that by winning the spelling bees and getting our kids into prestigious colleges. And doing a better job than others. Well, doctors are starting to prove that they can deliver better and more affordable healthcare if they're just left alone to do that. And so it's hard right now. It's sort of analogous to the way the pioneers of the homeschooling movement were operating in the 1970s. But I would like to see those parallel medical institutions grow in scope and in influence. And, you know, basically today, homeschooling is now not only mainstreamed and permitted in all 50 states, but it has circled back and influenced the charter school movement and to some extent even the public schools, who now have to sort of compete with other people that are, you know, doing things better in many respects. It doesn't mean that every experiment in homeschooling succeeded, just like every experiment in creating new small-scale healthcare delivery systems is not going to succeed. But we have to let those flowers bloom. We have to see which models work and which don't work. maybe there's going to be regional variations, which is why you need to allow for some degree of localized control. So moving away from a centralized bureaucracy toward a more decentralized system, you know, if Republicans can do little things around the edges with deregulation and with dialing back a little bit of the top-down control, I think creative doctors and patient advocacy groups and so forth at the local level will have a little bit more elbow room to start maneuvering, and you'll start seeing some creative solutions happening.
Doctor, concierge medicine, it's something I've looked into myself, yeah. And I feel like it's something a lot of people are going to want, but it's so expensive now. Do you
That's
see
right.
that becoming yeah. bigger and more affordable for normal people?
So it is growing. Certainly it's physicians like it much better, and patients who can afford it like it much better. But as you just pointed out, the challenge is that it's very expensive. So it's going to be out of reach for most ordinary Americans. But there's a model known as direct primary care, which is sort of concierge like, but it's available for everyone. It involves physicians sort of taking control over small group practices and cutting out the insurance company and dealing directly with a pool of patients who basically subscribe to their services in order to get healthcare that is more affordable precisely because it cuts out the middleman. And I think some of those models of direct primary care, they're analogous to concierge medicine, but they're proving to be economically sustainable and more affordable for a larger number of patients whose healthcare premiums, if they're paying for private insurance, have just gone through the roof in recent years, as all of us have probably experienced trying to, even if we're employed and our employer pays for part of our premiums, a big chunk of our private healthcare insurance, what comes out of our pocket to get decent insurance is often ridiculously expensive for ordinary American families. So I'm not saying that direct primary care is going to be the answer to everything, but it's one of the models that I discuss at the end of Making the Cut that's starting to gain traction, and in many cases, it's proving to be viable.
Doctor, thank you as always. I appreciate it. Your cell phone. Specifically, the company you use. Is it Verizon? Do you remember Arctic Frost, this huge investigation going on right now? Remember what all these senators came out and said? Verizon just flat out handed over all their data. No muss, no fuss, just grabbed it and worked with the Cheka immediately. Do you have one of these big soulless mobile companies that hates your guts that would turn you into the feds in a heartbeat? Why don't you switch to Pure Talk? You'll save a fortune. You're not going to sacrifice everything. They're on the same towers. Switch to Pure Talk. Veteran-led. Right now, they're giving rescue dogs to vets with PTSD. That's my cell phone company. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, well, there's very clearly a shift that's happening now, and you're going to see it happening in the coming days, a shift from the Trump administration focusing on a lot of foreign affairs, which they've been, you know, Ukraine and trade deals and things like that, to domestic. They have heard the domestic displeasure with the economy, and it seems like they're going to focus on that. Joining me now, Carol Roth, two-time best-selling author, recovering former investment banker. Okay, Carol, the administration is going to focus domestically. Some of that might be good. Some of that might be bad. What kind of things are they tossing out there? What is this, dividend? What?
Well, first of all, I've got three letters for you. TYS, told you so. I knew this was going to be happen. We talked about the choreography of focusing on affordability, because that is the reason that President Trump was put into office. It was the number one thing that people were concerned about. So I give the administration props for now, you know, starting to home in on this. The challenge is that some of the ideas that are coming out are a little nutty, so we're going to need to work through them and hopefully twist it and change things around. On the tariff front, we know that the tariffs are in front of the Supreme Court right now, and I think to try to drum up more support on the president's side, he is now throwing out the idea of stimulus checks, basically $2,000 tariff rebates, whatnot. Although Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, has walked that back. They're floating ideas like 50-year mortgages to keep you indebted to the bank forever. I mean, might as well at this point have $200 mortgages and just keep it in the family for a few generations. So some of these ideas are a little wacky. But, we want to be positive, we want to be optimistic, and we want to be problem solvers. So we want to say, hey, here are the ways we can approach these things you're talking about and make them better. On the tariff fronts, I think the biggest gift that SCOTUS could give the president is by striking down the tariffs, but also making them basically proactive, but not reactive in terms of their non-application. Refunding is going to be a big issue, even though it's money that they shouldn't have gotten, and a lot of people will want that back from a purely gift to the president standpoint, saying we're drawing a line on the stand. It will be a boon to the market. It'll be a boon to the economy. And if the president is able to let that go and refocus, then he can start focusing on some of the different options for affordability in lots of different categories.
Okay, we'll come back to the affordability thing. I want you to expand a little bit on how does this help us if the Supreme Court strikes down some tariff stuff? How does this translate into things being more affordable for normal people?
Well, the tariffs are a tax. You can call it a licensing fee, you can call it an extra fee, but ultimately it's extra money that is paid by businesses and then ultimately consumers that's going to the government. So in my world, that is a tax, and having more taxes is a bad thing, which I think most of us can agree to. So if we can get rid of the tariffs, if we can say, that is not in an emergency power, that it doesn't match up with emergency powers, these tariffs that he is undertaking, then I think that it's a good thing because people won't have that extra cost. Businesses will have more certainty. The market will have more certainty on policy, and it will allow the Trump administration, instead of focusing on this relentlessly, to focus in other areas which are desperately needed. So I think that's going to be a benefit all around. Now, certainly, even if they strike them down, he could just, dig in and he could take his proposals to Congress and try to get them to put those into law. But if that path opens up, if the Supreme Court offers the gift, I hope somebody says, please take the gift.
Okay, let's focus on affordability here. And I understand that we have decades and decades and decades of idiotic fiscal policy that has made us, it's made housing unaffordable. We'll just focus on that portion of it. And right. So look, if you're a populist president, you can throw out ideas like 50-year mortgage all you want, much as I hate that idea. It doesn't fix any of the foundational problems. Do you sense the administration is at all focused on the foundational problems that make life unaffordable for younger people?
I hope so. I think that when many of us spoke out and said, 50-year mortgages doesn't fix the affordability issue, it's just basically monetizing it. I think that some of the people involved in the administration picked up on other ideas that have been floated. I've floated ideas, I think I've talked to you about some of them before, like making mortgages assumable and portable. And so some folks in the administration have said that they are considering that as well. So that gives me at least a moment of optimism to say, okay, this is not the only thing that they're going to consider, and this is the first trial balloon that they're floating. I think that one's sort of gone over more like a lead balloon, but hopefully they will get involved in some of the things that they can. There are certain things that they won't be able to get directly involved, things like zoning issues at the local level, but by the president using his platform to shine a light on them, them, I do think he can create that kind of pressure and then help people sort of double down on that pressure to do what needs to be done at the local and state level while he's doing the things he can do at the federal level.
Carol, what do we think about this meatpacking collusion? What did he call it? Illicit collusion and price fixing. This is something the Trump administration has spoken out about. I understand there is a beef shortage in the country. Anyone who's tried to buy a T-bone at the grocery store is well aware that there is a beef shortage of some kind in the country. What is going on?
Yes, well, obviously, I am not a rancher and I don't even play one in a great drama on television, but obviously there are issues. And, you know, it's interesting how politicians, you know, even the president, tend to go to big bad corporations and collusion and price fixing. And if that's happening, they should absolutely stop that. But where they never go, where I think they should go, is the deregulation and helping the smaller players in the industry. I've heard from many people, you know, whether it's related to ranching or farming, that there are restrictions that make it harder for them to do business. And we should be making it as easy as possible for them to do business and to feed the country. And so going back to one of the tenets that they ran on, the deregulation, the focus on Main Street America, on our ranchers, on our farmers. Yes, we want to get rid of collusion with the big guys, but we want to make it easier for the small guys to compete. And that is something that they should be focused on highly.
Now, Carol, as we wrap this up here, the Trump administration, at least the first time, they were pretty daggone good about deregulation. That is something Trump does very, very well. He's big on that. Are they not focusing on that as much this time?
I think they got distracted. I think it should have been the first thing that they focused on out of the gate, as well as the making the tax code permanent. They obviously got the latter piece of that done, but the tariff policy and shoring some of that up, which some part of that has actually been great. So let me give the president props. You know, things like focusing on rare earth elements and securing our border and national security, like some of those things are really good and we're really glad he did it. But I do think the focus on tariff and some of the international trade didn't give them as much time to focus on Main Street. You know, even something like we've talked about, the Corporate Transparency Act, they haven't even come out with the final rule yet. So that hasn't been codified. So they've taken some steps in that direction, but they need to do massive deregulation, particularly as it pertains to the things that create barriers for small businesses in this country. We want this country to grow and to thrive. It benefits everyone. And that starts with the backbone of the economy. So deregulation and helping out the little guys in a very pro-free market way makes all the sense in the world.
Carol, I'm so glad you're with us and you're not an investment banker anymore. Come back soon. I'm a chip man. Everyone who knows me knows I'm a chip man. In fact, Ob was just texting me yesterday. We have this big Thanksgiving thing we're going to. She said, hey, what kind of sides should we bring? I said, some chips. I'm a chip man. But I'm also 44. And the days of walking in the gas station and getting a bag of hot Cheetos have to be behind me. What to do? What to do? Well, that's what Massa Chips is all about. Massa Chips, these wonderful three-ingredient chips. No seed oils, none of that filth. You can actually eat them guilt-free. You're not going to feel tired and fat and bloated and upset. No, guilt-free. Oh, but they must be gross then, right? Well, this is me. I would tell you if it was gross. You know, I'm not one of these health freaks. They're fantastic. Fantastic. You just, now normal chips taste gross to me. Want to try them? Big fat discount for you. MassaChips.com/JesseTV.
You also do have to bring in talent. When
well, we
a country
have plenty of talented people
no,
here.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
We don't have talented
being,
people
no,
here.
No, you don't have certain talents, and people have to learn.
Well, those comments are going over like a fart in church today, and we thought we should probably talk to Dave Brad about that. Joining me now, Senior Vice President of Business Relations at Liberty University. Dave, Donald Trump is not making many fans with his base with those kinds of things. He's already rolling Scott Bissett out there on the news to try to soften that landing. But people were concerned, Dave. Frankly, they're angry.
Yeah, no, they should be. The America First agenda, you know, Trump, he's feeling the pressure from all sides, right? All the corporate buddies are screaming at him, saying we want the cheap and easy route we've had to make our profits for Wall Street and Main Street. Sorry. And Bessent came out and said it's Main Street's turn. And so the whole country's waiting, right? I mean, they're being patient on the wars, Ukraine. We want that thing done. We want all the wars rolled up. We want to see this Department of Justice lay down the hammer and see some results come on in. And so this is a biggie, though. The immigration, the border, when you shut down the border, why are you doing that? And so, you know, I think he's going to feel some heat on this one.
Dave, I'm curious as to why. I have my own theories. The one that I really hope is not true is that we have an immigration bill coming that's going to be putrid because of our thin majority in the House, and this is Trump prepping the ground for that. I pray to God I'm wrong about that, but tell me why. Is it just what you just said? Is it his big business buddies in his ear? No, I don't want to pay wages.
Yeah, well, you know, just ask yourself similarly, why are we voting for a $7 trillion Biden budget again with a lot of Democrat stuff left in it with $2 trillion deficits? And the answer is because your representatives aren't representing the people. And so same thing on this. Most every, you know, especially just go around the horn, right? Go to any state with a bunch of golf resorts and hotels and whatever, and I'll guarantee it, those congressmen and senators and women are going to be pretty friendly to cheap labor. And they're just smacking their own people on the head. You know, when the president says we don't have the talent, we don't have the talent, right? I've been in education my whole life because the corporate guys are planting, you know, evergreen trees on their rooftops and ceilings as virtue signaling instead of investing into kids right down across the block from you, right? In Chicago, the poor kids, the literacy rate, the reading rate, right, for the third graders is 12%. That's not from rightwing.com, right? That's from the Illinois Public Policy Institute. And so, yeah, all these corporate guys, oh, we're in favor of ethics and we care and we got pink ribbons and we got all sorts of cool stuff. But the kids right next door can't read. We're for a diversity and race and gender and all those kids across all those categories right downstairs can't read. So, you know, I'm a little cynical, but if you want to change the country, you better teach the kids to read.
Dave, I understand that what we're about to talk about doesn't necessarily apply to Liberty University, of course, but Trump also said that we got to have these 600,000 Chinese students. We just got to have them. It's just wonderful for the country, and we certainly don't want any universities to go out of business. Well, the American people, certainly the MAGA movement, we don't want 600,000 Chinese spies, and we don't give a crap if half the university system goes out of business. Frankly, it should. What is this? Is this part of the trade deal we just struck with China, and he's just trying to sell it now?
No, this is probably, yes to that, but also, in addition, the tech bros are putting huge pressure, and they're the huge donors, right? The Magnificent Seven firms, the trillionaire class. What people may not know is about 75% of the Fortune 500 CEOs are Democrat. Most all of the Magnificent Seven trillionaires are leftist. And but they're big donors, and the Republicans don't have anyone left, right? We gave 20% of the economy away to Obamacare, and so, you know, it's kind of a survival thing. We don't have Hollywood, we don't have education. You mentioned Liberty University, et cetera. But what people, the average person, doesn't know is the Chinese students have to sign a document, and all workers here, to the CCP, right? We don't hate the Chinese people, but the Communist Party we don't like. And they have to sign a document saying they're basically, in essence, spying, as you said, for the CCP. And so if they want to come over here, I think that if the CCP would sign a simple document saying that the CCP and the Chinese government believes like we do that all people are made in the image of God and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they sign their name to that document, hey, welcome to the U.S. of A. But until you sign that document saying that, no way, Jose.
Trump also said this about the economy.
This is the greatest economy we've ever had. Their talking points, oh, costs are high. By the way, the only thing is beef. Beef.
Coffee.
Is a little high because the ranchers are doing great. Coffee, we're going to lower some tariffs. We're going to have some coffee come in. We're going to take care of all this stuff very quickly, very easily. It's surgical. It's beautiful to watch.
Dave, I understand that, and I'm totally fine with the Trump bluster thing. It's who he is. Frankly, it's endearing. Everything's the best ever, the most beautiful ever, the hottest ever. I get that that's Trump's way. I get that. But the economy is not good, and people recently could afford a lot more than they afford now. And telling people how great it is, it's a little insulting.
Yeah, well, I've tried to counsel whoever I can up there in the swamp that's advising the president. I never would have pivoted and cheerleaded that we own the economy, right? We had 20% inflation in Biden's 4 years, right? That's a ratchet effect, right? Unless you get deflation or disinflation, those prices stay there. And so we never should have started cheerleading and said, you know, we're going to lower price. That's the job of the Federal Reserve for the most part, right? The price level, to have stable prices. So that's the inflation debate. I never would have gone there. And then on productivity, I've been preaching for 10 years. Productivity's been going down for 70 years in a row. And so what Trump should say is, and I give him an A-plus on this thing, the major thing that enhances productivity and GDP growth and wages is capital investment. And that's where he's crushing it, right? That's where he's doing good. But he's got a big problem in the short run, right? Because that capital, right? 2 trillion U.S. commitments, 10 trillion foreign commitments coming in, that'll take a few years to get put in the workers' hands. And if you put capital in the American people's hands, they're going to do great things with it. They always have. Just think of Henry Ford or whatever, right? The American people are ready to roll. And so Biden put us in the ditch. The left has put us in the ditch. Our geopolitical strategists missed a country called China for the past 30 years, got it all wrong. They're our friend. You know, their kids are going to be rich and become Democrat, yuppies. Nope, they're still communists. And so I just never would have pivoted to, you know, saying I own this economy because economically, he doesn't, right? Monetary policy's got a year lag, and fiscal policy's got a year to a year and a half lag once it's implemented, right? And so that's the truth of economics.
Is this why he leans on Jerome Powell so hard? Is this why he just blasts away? Obviously, he's trying to push him into something. Is this what this is all about?
Yeah, well, that's right, because in the short run, he's just got a few levers, right? So if he can lower the interest rate, you know, that'll juice things up. And, you know, there's news out today, right? I saw the rental properties are more deflationary than we thought, which is bad news for the economy. But, you know, that maybe there is some wiggle room to lower rates, right? If you lower rates, the risk is you get inflation, right? So if inflation's at 3 instead of 2, and it should be 0. And so if you pump more money out there and lower interest rates, you get more inflation. But the I don't have time to get into it. But the Federal Reserve is a bunch of crooks, right? They've ruined the economy since 2008 with the financial crisis and the bailouts, and the Fed put. They always bail out the Greenspan put, bails out Wall Street, and no concern for the employment and wages of Main Street.
Dave, appreciate you as always, brother. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. That was a bit of a heavy show, so we thought it would be appropriate to lighten the mood and remind me, that as much as we may get frustrated from time to time with the current administration, boy, did we dodge a bullet in November.
I was aware of my opponent's strategy, and I wasn't about to fall prey or fall into those traps. And part of his strategy and those around him was to try and take me off our game and message. And I wasn't about to be distracted by those little, those flames that he was trying to throw to get me away from what my highest priority, which was talking to people about the economy and their well-being in terms of their financial well-being. And that's, so I understood the game that was being played, and I made a decision that I wasn't going to get played. And
chestnut checkers, got it.
Chestnut checkers.
Yeah, three-dimensional chess, I'm telling you, you know.
Three-dimensional chess? Versus what other kind? I think, you know what? I'll see you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.